today I continue my 7-part series on Unitarian Universalist principles, focusing on the fourth, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. When I did this sermon in the first hour, it was all turgid. It was a search, but it was very cloudy, so I threw away about 800 words. Now, I have made the claim a couple of times in the course of this series that the deep taproot of our tradition is in the Bible, and that's true, a good bit of it, but there's a second root, and that is the classics of antiquity, by which I mean primarily the Greeks. We claim, rightly, a special relationship with the Greek philosophical tradition, and especially with the high value the Greeks placed on reason. This morning I want to consider the classical Greek tradition and Unitarian Universalism's connection to it. What does it mean that we honor reason? How does that make us different from other religions? And how can we individually and collectively and honorably live out our tradition today? There is a quip about Unitarian churches. Here all your answers are questioned. Like most witticisms, there's an element of truth to it. In the words of the late George Marshall, don't come to a Unitarian Universalist church to be given a religion, come to develop your own religion. Unitarian Universalists are people who are expected to use their own minds and to arrive at their own rational conclusions. Here are people going to a church where everyone does not think alike, but all alike think. Here you will never hear the minister say, as some of you perhaps heard when you were growing up, stop asking so many questions and just believe. Not here. As Robert Weston so eloquently affirmed in our responsive reading, we UUs cherish our doubts. Or as the Reverend Angus McLean used to say to me and the rest of the Sunday school students back in my youth, he said it in a Scottish brogue, I'll just say it my way. Keep your thinking caps on, children, whenever you come to church. Over the centuries, there have been three main views regarding the relationship between reason and faith. The majority view, essentially, is that they're not at all related, really. They're often in conflict. It has been well summed up, I think, with Soren Kierkegaard's expression about a leap of faith. The idea that reason will only take you so far in the spiritual realm, and then at a certain point, you have to make a leap of faith in order to appreciate religious truth. That religious truth is of a different order than run-of-the-mill everyday truth. Thus, reason will take you only so far, and then you have to make a leap. The late Stephen Jay Gould talked about this in terms of two magisteriums, the humanistic or humanities magisterium and the scientific magisterium, and that they're not at all related. Others say that reason and faith are not exactly in conflict, that religious truth transcends reason without flat out contradicting it. Many mystically inclined UUs adopt essentially this view, like Henry David Thoreau. That is, that the religious experience, while not contradicting reason, is transrational. It is not irrational, but transrational. What contradictions appear really are resolved on a higher level, if you can find your way there. The third view, and that most common among the UUs I've known, I guess, is that reason is in complete harmony with religion or faith, that their content is identical, and that reason sets forth cogently what faith feels and practices. Justin Martyr, John Scotus Erigina, and the German idealist Hegel all defended this position from different points of view, that reason and religion are ultimately harmonious. And so did the Greek philosopher Plato. It was Plato, I guess, who asked all the key philosophical questions, which I want to focus a little bit on. Like a lot of things in life, the answers to fundamental questions are subject to fashion. Answers to philosophical questions come into fashion, fall out of fashion, and then come back into fashion decades or even centuries later. But while the various answers do change over the centuries, it was Plato, 2,600 years ago in ancient Greece, who first asked all the critical questions. He might not have been the first to ask, but he was the first to write it down. Before Plato, everything was oral. Philosophy was something that happened in the marketplace. Plato's dialogues take place, all of them, in the marketplace too. But there's this crucial difference. Plato wrote it down so that we can study it in a book, sitting at home in our living room or at the library. And those books subsequently became the foundation upon which subsequent Western philosophy has been built. Now, people look at Plato and they look for consistency in vain, and they throw up their hands. It's not there. There is a consistency, but it's not in the content. It's in the method. And that method of truth-seeking is what we call dialectic, talking back and forth in a leisurely question-and-answer format. And it's a way to get at underlying, often unexamined, assumptions. But here's the thing. Anytime you're in real communication with somebody, you are engaged in dialectic. Most of the time, we're not really doing that, though. And most of the time, we're engaged in what Plato called aristics. And aristic is the same root as error, and we all know how to do it. When Amy and I are talking, and she's talking to me, and I'm already thinking about my answer while she's talking. Maybe she's doing the same, thinking, no, I know the answer. Well, a lot of what we do is that way. In too many conversations I have with my brother, for instance, I'm trying to convert him, and he's trying to change my mind, and it's just how it goes. It's all heuristic. Dialectic is entirely different. In dialectic, I'm not trying to convert Amy or my brother or anyone else, nor are they trying to change my mind. Rather, we are going searching together for what answers we may find. That's the design, the ideal behind all dialectical conversation. It is the free and responsible way to converse. Reason to the Greeks was understood to be logos. In the beginning, John Gottlieb, in the beginning was the word, was logos. The creative principle. That is the organizing principle in life and all reality. Why is it that the math scientists and engineers living in Houston could do inside their head would take a spaceship, many of them, all the way to the moon and land on it and come back all the way. Why is it that we can do math in our head and it works like that across the whole universe? It's because this cosmic ordering principle, reason, runs through everything. It's why everything hangs together as one whole. Another way to conceptualize it, the Chinese symbol of the Tao, or yin-yang. The Tao is not a thing, it's a pattern. Tao is pattern, primal pattern. Within that pattern, yang is logos, and yin is the receptive, profound, and eternal female. The masculine yang, logos, inseminates the feminine yin, and out of that cosmic primal insemination, all reality, everything, comes to birth. And it's the same for Plato, for whom the logos, reason, is far more than just ratiocination. It's sort of a ubiquitous, unseen, seminal energy infusing all nature. It runs through everything, including us and our central nervous systems. We partake of this logos to the degree that we disenthrall ourselves of ego and egoistic ideas and humbly engage in real dialectic. The truth-finding method that I've been trying to describe that was practiced by Socrates, and that has many parallels, incidentally, with the non-violent practices Pam Orbach has been teaching us here at church these last 2 years. Now, to get back to the seven principles, understanding reason this way as logos, an ordering principle running totally infused throughout nature, makes it similar to justice and compassion in that they too are ubiquitous and that they too are inextricably entwined into the nature of reality. As I said in the second sermon in this series, the prophets Micah, Amos, Isaiah, and the rest declare in their Old Testament prophecies that justice is somehow part of the very essence of nature. The law of love and reciprocity is clear, maintain the prophets. Treat people with generosity, they'll come back to you, treat them poorly, and you'll get that. Compassion can be understood to operate in much the same way. Compassion is embedded in and through the nature of reality. By allowing oneself to feel the suffering of others, be they one's own children, one's neighbor's children, or children halfway around the world, we wake up to our connection, our identity, really, with those children, with all of them. Now here come the Greeks telling us that reason works the same way, too. That the order, consistency, and unity of nature are all aspects of this divine ordering principle that runs through life, that is called logos. Recognizing this, recognizing the reasonableness, order, and unity of nature does not weaken faith, it builds it, strengthens it. Reason and rational apprehension are themselves among the most beautiful, wonderful aspects of life on earth. And they tell us something about the forces that have brought the world into being. And that's why we bring them here with us to church and hold them up. If there's a problem in practicing our Unitarian Universalist fourth principle, it is this: a free and disciplined search for truth does not necessarily mean finding it. Perhaps this is the biggest difference between Unitarian Universalism and more orthodox traditions. We do not claim to have the answers. We encourage you, instead, to do your best to live the questions, to welcome the questions, and to follow the questions with an inquiring heart and mind. So it is that we encourage, anyway, I encourage our members to practice a letting go faith. I call letting go faith, as opposed to a clinging faith. A clinging faith isn't really faith at all. It's belief. It's where you're holding on to some tenets or propositions, sometimes with white knuckles, in the face of struggle, anxiety, and worry. Whereas a letting go faith is a faith in which, despite not knowing, one's open mind and open heart are enough to carry them along. Ours is a letting go faith. But a faith confident in the wholesomeness and centrality of reason in all of our lives, and of the value of using that reason to understand our lives more fully. I close now with a quotation about how to live that letting go faith, a quotation by the German idealistic poet Rainer Maria Rilke, who wrote, "I would like to beg you to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a very foreign language. Don't search for the answers which could not be given to you now because you are not yet ready to live them. And the point is to live everything. Live the questions now. Perhaps someday far in the future, you will gradually, without even noticing it, live your way into an answer. So may it be. And so may it be for all of us."